Amateur Traveler, episode 746. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about permafrost and potholes, pioneers and pipelines, the Arctic Circle and the Aurora Borealis, as we drive the Dalton Highway in Alaska. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about the Dalton Highway. I'd like to welcome back to the show Eric Smith, who's come to talk to us about a road trip in Alaska. Eric, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back, Chris. Thanks.
And I say welcome back to the show. If you have listened to Amateur Traveler for a long time, this is, we believe, the ninth time that Eric has come on the show talking predominantly about national parks. And Eric, you have a list of the different episodes you've been on. You want to list them quick?
We did National Parks, which was 121. 183 was Yellowstone and Grand Teton. 236 was Michigan. 278 was the National Parks of the Four Corners region. 341 was New Zealand's South Island. 375 was Amsterdam. And the last two were 617, South Florida and the Keys. And 665, which was Washington, D.C.'s National Park sites.
Excellent. But you're come to talk to us about a road trip this time.
Yeah, road trip up the enigmatic Dalton Highway in Alaska, which starts just north of Fairbanks and runs not quite to the Arctic Ocean, but to the oil-producing town of Dead Horse in Prudhoe Bay. And as we'll talk about later, to get to the actual Arctic Ocean, you have to do a little tour out there. But you're pretty darn close, and it's a long trip.
Well, and I was intrigued because we've established that you've done some traveling, certainly a lot of domestic travel with a goal to see all the national parks in the U.S., but also some international travel. And you said this was your favorite trip.
It was right there with the South Island of New Zealand for sure. Yeah, it was so singular. I like those experiences, something that's just completely different and not something. This was something that I should tell the story of how I got obsessed with the Dalton Highway back when I was younger. And this is where my national parks obsession came from. My dad was a teacher, and we would go on these long summer road trips, and I would sit in the passenger seat with him, and I had the old paper Rand McNally Atlas, which sadly has mostly become a thing of the past. But people our age will remember that fondly. And instead of reading novels along the way, I was my dad's navigator, and I would flip through the Rand McNally Road Atlas looking at all these cool, amazing places to go. And the very small map they included of Alaska in there had this road that ran out of Fairbanks that was in like white, almost like pencil-like writing, and it said Dalton Highway, parentheses, closed to the public. And I thought, ooh, that sounds interesting. And then later on, when I worked at a travel bookstore in Chicago for a while and I got my hands on my first copy of the Mile Post, I was able to see that they had opened up this closed to the public road in 1994 for private travel. So I became sort of obsessed with eventually doing it. And in 2019, I figured it was time to do it. I didn't think I'd find anybody crazy enough to want to go with me, but my friend Pat heard about it and was intrigued by it and agreed to fly to Fairbanks and do 6 days with me, including four on the Dalton Highway.
Excellent. Now, we often have guests who come on the show and say that phrase that I hate, which is, and there's something there for everyone. This trip is not necessarily one of those trips?
Oh, yeah. It's not one of those trips.
So we always ask, why should someone do the Dalton Highway? Who should do the Dalton Highway?
Well, I mean, as I've said on my previous podcasts, I preach doing your research. You got to make sure you do your research before you do anything. And with the Dalton Highway, if you Google it, the first 6 or 7 articles that come up are going to talk about nothing but the danger. And that's not really how it is. It's not, I wouldn't refer to it as dangerous. It can be if you're stupid enough to not heed the warnings. But it takes some effort.
And the warnings aren't things like low-flying pterodactyls or something like that. What kind of warnings are we talking about?
I think the one that I see most often ignored was the speed thing. We saw some people, the truckers. Now, this is one of those, some people are familiar with ice road truckers.
Right.
Dalton Highway's been on that a few times. And most of the year when it's just mostly gravel and some pace stretches, people do not pay attention to the advice that you're given to do 30 to 40 miles an hour. And you see people flying down this road and you're thinking, okay, that's a flat tire waiting to happen. And that's, I think, the most common thing that happens on this road is flat tires.
Got it.
I'm not a huge adventure travel guy. This is probably as far as I would go, but I would not advise anybody to take this lightly.
Okay. Tell us more about the Dalton Highway.
Okay. So to get to the Dalton, you're going to have to go through Fairbanks. there are tour companies that go out of Fairbanks that you can have them drive you part of it or all of it. Mm-hmm. And you can book those tours out of Fairbanks. We chose to rent a car, which are two rental car agencies in Fairbanks that will let you rent a car and drive up it yourself. Fairbanks is a transportation hub. It's not the prettiest city. It's got really good surroundings, but there's some tourist stuff there to do. The city itself, you hear Fairbanks, second biggest city in Alaska, and you're thinking, oh, this must be sizable. Well, the population of the city itself is only 32,000. The whole borough, which is a huge borough, is only 100,000. So this is not a population center. It has everything you need to stock up for a journey like this. Like, it has the Walmarts and the grocery stores and everything, but it's still not a big city. So, and it's not an ancient city either. The city was only settled in the 1900s. So it has not been around forever. And a lot of Northern Alaska's settlements were based around gold, and that was a transportation hub for the gold rush. So it looks a little weather beaten. It doesn't have any city skyline or anything. It really just is a transportation hub. It's got some interesting things to do. There's the University of Alaska Museum of the North, which is the thing we really enjoyed most about Fairbanks. You go over to the University of Alaska at Fairbanks campus, and this museum's perched on a hill there, and it's kind of a cool thing. The displays are great. It goes through all the modern history and all the ancient history, and it talks about the different regions of Alaska as well. It's also neat to walk around the campus of University of Alaska Fairbanks and try to imagine yourself going to college in a place like that with 45 below wind chills and a lot of the buildings connected by underground walkways and stuff because of how cold it gets during the winter. So,
and we should say this is coming not from somebody like me who lives in California, but somebody like you who lives in Michigan.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it makes Michigan's winters look pedestrian. So that's not to be taken lightly at all. Again, Fairbanks, there's things to do. There's Pioneer Park, which is like an open air museum. They have a couple smaller museums like the Air mm-hmm. Museum and the Native Museum, and they have a small gold rush town. It's sort of like a lot of those open air museums you find in Europe. It's sort of just trying to give you a slice of what life in Alaska is like. There's a old paddle boat that gets out on the Chena River, which runs right through downtown the middle of Fairbanks there. And there's cute things like there's a reindeer ranch right outside of town. There's an old time auto museum. You can sign up for gold dredging tours. And I mean, for me, when we got to Fairbanks, really all we were focused on was getting in that car and finally heading up the Dalton. So we didn't avail ourselves to a lot of this, but you could spend a decent amount of time in Fairbanks doing touristy stuff. So there are also some decent day trips outside of Fairbanks. There's down in a town called Nenana, there's the Alaska State Railroad Museum, which is a really interesting collection. And then also 14 or 15 miles to the east of Fairbanks is a town called North Pole, which you can go get pictures with the Santa Claus house and the big North Pole sign. Even though you're a long ways away from the North Pole, it's still something I think that appeals to a lot of tourists. The day trip we did on our day before we hit the Dalton was out to a place called Chena Hot Springs. And this is natural hot springs that were discovered about 10 years or so after Fairbanks became a settlement. It's about an hour drive. It is a perfect drive to take if you are driving the Dalton to take before, because while it is paved the whole way, it sort of gives you an idea of what you're going to be doing. The road is paved, but it has all these frost heaves, which is when the water builds up below and then freezes, it can make these, it makes the road uneven, to say the least. There's dips, and then there's places where you lurch real bad. It serves as a real good hour-long introduction into what you're getting yourself into. But the resort at Chena Hot Springs itself is great. Like I said, there's an indoor and an outdoor heated pool, and they have a nice restaurant on site. So it does make for a real nice day trip. I know we'll talk about the Northern Lights later, but people who aren't going to get on the Dalton who want to see the Northern Lights, Chena Hot Springs offers some tours that include, hopefully, viewing of the Aurora Borealis. Yeah, it's a perfect day trip from Fairbanks. We spent 3 or 4 hours out there, and during most of the year, you can do plane flights and like scenic viewing flights over some of the Alaskan bush. There's a lot to do out there. And we went in September, the very beginning of September. So a lot of after Labor Day, a lot of the tourist stuff had shut down.
Okay.
So it was interesting for us because we still were able to catch a lot of what was going on. But
so it sounds like you would recommend going in the summer before Labor Day so you don't have things shut down.
I would also say this, though. The time we went at the beginning of September, while some stuff wasn't shut down, we got lucky because fall is very short in Alaska, mm-hmm. but even the trip out to Chena Hot Springs, the white birch were in, had changed colors. So we were confronted with a sea of yellow everywhere from these incredible white birches. And then on the way down, by the time we, 3 or 4 days since we went up, they had already started to leave the trees. That's how short the season is there. Hmm. We really enjoyed September. I will say one thing we got really lucky on. We didn't have the mosquitoes that you hear the legendary sure. stories about Alaskan mosquitoes. We did not have the problem with that in September that they do in June, early sure. June. I think the road also would be in really bad shape, but also the bugs would be something else.
Okay. Good safety tip there.
Okay. So the Dalton Highway itself, it was built to service the oil fields up in Prudhoe Bay. It was built between 1973 and 1975. It was designed to be a supply road. This was not supposed to be a tourist road at all. And from Fairbanks itself, it's 500 miles. The pipeline itself, which runs from Prudhoe Bay all the way down to the Gulf of Alaska and Valdez, where a lot of the tankers pick up the oil, that is over 800 miles long. And that pipeline was finished in 1977. They actually built almost 400 miles of this in a single summer just to service the oil fields.
Oh, my.
So it's an amazing engineering feat. I mean, after bouncing along it for 4 days, I doubt the engineering feat is going to be lost on some people. But it's still an incredible engineering feat to have put together this much road in that short a time. Estimates listed at 75% gravel and 25% paved. Both my friend Pat and I thought it was more like 70-30 or even more than that towards the pave. There were more paved stretches than I think we expected. Now, saying that, we actually like driving on the unpaved more than the paved. The paved, most of them, unless it was a new stretch, the paved stuff had these massive potholes, and it was like playing a video game, trying to dodge the potholes. Now, on the paved section, we were down into 20 to 25 miles per hour in a lot of that, because you just, the last thing you want when you're 250 miles away from a service station is to have to get a service call, which you couldn't do anyway except over CB because you have no cell signal.
Got it. Did your rental car come with a CB?
It did. It came with a CB. It also came with a really nice emergency tool / well-stocked toolkit with two spare tires. It had everything. The car company we went through was Arctic Outfitters, and they did a fantastic, they've done this for a long time, so they have these cars set up so that even dumb tourists like myself can get by with these, so that you're not putting yourself out there. And the CB radio was incredibly useful as well, because there are actually a bunch of turns and a bunch of places where you need to call out before you go around a blind turn, or when you're going up a hill, you want to let the truckers know that you're coming up.
Huh. Were there signs to remind you to do that?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And they tell you, as I mentioned, we'll get back, well, I'll talk about resources for this in a minute, but the milepost, the North Country Bible, are you familiar with the milepost? It's a gigantic, almost magazine-type book, and okay. they've been doing this for 50 years or so, and it covers all of Alaska's roads, and it is basically a mile-by-mile direction of the road. And for the purposes of the Dalton, they had a rental car. I bought the milepost in advance, but they had a laminated copy of the Dalton, and it's incredible how detailed it is. It tells you at what mile marker there's just a turnout to the west. It's not named or anything, just a turnout. So as you're going up, you know right where you'd be able to stop. And it also points out the major sites that you want to see as well. That is an absolute, if you're going to drive the Dalton Highway, the rental car company will give you, like I say, the laminated copy of it. But I would buy the milepost before and absolutely read the section on the Dalton before you head out. Another resource for before you head out on the Dalton is Alaska 511. It is the Department of Transportation site there. And it tells you what condition the road is in certain places. And Pat and I pored over this for the 2 months leading up to the trip, looking every day and texting back and forth and saying, oh, my goodness, did you see this section of red? Because 2 weeks before we left, a large portion of the highway was red. And we were looking at it and thinking, oh, boy, what did we get ourselves into here? And it goes by color. Green is obviously a good stretch. And then it goes all the way to red where you're like not advised trying to do it. And they had some real bad rains like the last couple weeks of August. And we were looking, you hold your cursor down the road and it shows you where the bad stretches are. And so much of it was bad. We were terrified at that point in time. But as you'll hear, things did get better. The other resource to look at is there's a lot of BLM brochures out there. They had a really good one, and I went to try to find you the link to put in the show notes, and they have changed it to a much harder to read one, which I don't understand at all. The one we had before we went was wonderful.
Well, and you say BLM, Bureau of Land Management. What are you driving through predominantly BLM land?
A lot of BLM land.
Okay.
Yes. Yep.
Which means that you can camp if you want to, but is that where you're staying along the way? Or are you stopping in places with hotels? Or what does one find along the Dalton Highway?
You can do both. You can camp. There are some campgrounds, but generally there's only one place to stop, and that's in the middle at Coldfoot, and then you get up to Dead Horse on Prudhoe Bay, and that's the other place you stop. And generally, I'd say most of the people are in the hotels, and the hotels are expensive,
okay,
as you would figure in such a remote area. We availed ourselves of two B&Bs in a tiny town north of Coldfoot called Wiseman, which is a population 22, and I'll get to the lodging there. That would be – so that's one thing that – when Chariot did her podcast on the Dalton, they stayed in the hotel in Coldfoot, which I'm sure it's perfectly fine. But the experience we had, we actually had on the way up and the way back, we stayed in two different B&Bs in Wiseman and really enjoyed both. And it was a nice, because the hotel in Dead Horse that you're going to stay in are these industrial hotels made for oil workers. They're on stilts because with the permafrost, you can't build them on the ground. All the plumbing is above ground. They're just, it's a very surreal experience.
Well, and you mentioned the episode we did with Sherry Ott on remote Alaska, which talked in part about the first part, the first half of the Dalton Highway.
Yeah.
That isn't probably, I'd say, the highlight of that show for me was talking about Wrangell St. Elias and some of the other places we talked about, like Nome. But we did get into a little bit of this drive on that particular episode, which is
496.
There you go. I knew you'd have the number in front of you.
I do. You also talked about Gates of the Arctic National Park with Gary
right.
Arndt when he did Alaska National Parks in 652. That one, you're 3 miles from it. And you know me with national parks. I want to check off a national park. But on the Dalton Highway, you are 3 miles from the border of the park at one point in time. But the only way, there's no roads into it. None,
right.
Zero, zilch. So the only way to get to it would have been a 3-mile hike overland through mud bogs and forest. And that's just not me. So we visited the visitor center in Coldfoot. And I still sit and bite myself all the time. Do I count this as a park I visited? Do I not count it? I'm going with no, because it's a massive, very cool park that you mostly have to take a plane into.
Right.
So, yeah, you can cheat a little bit and learn a lot about it at the visitor center in Coldfoot. But generally, most people don't make the 3-mile hike into the park borders itself proper.
Well, do we want to talk about the experience itself? Kind of break it down into segments?
Sure. The pipeline will be with you the whole way. And since we're talk about the pipeline at the beginning, the reason the whole thing exists is you start out in Fairbanks, and to even get to the Dalton, you have to drive 85 miles on another highway called the Elliott Highway, which is paved the whole way. There isn't a lot to see on there. Just a few miles outside of Fairbanks, there is a rest area stop where it teaches you about the pipeline, which is really helpful, I think, because again, for the next, whatever, 4 days, that's how we did it, two up and two back. That pipeline is sitting next to you the whole time. So it's good to learn a lot about it. They take you up close. They show you what the inside of it looks, and it's fascinating to see. So, but along the Elliott Highway on the way to the Dalton, that's really it. There's a place to get gas a couple miles north of there, and that's it. And then the Elliott Highway, the junction where the Dalton starts is at a place called Levengood, which we didn't even see a town there. I didn't see a town sign or anything. I think it's just a junction. But when you get there, there is a sign that says Dalton Highway. They have the sign elevated to about 8 feet high, which means I think it's been stolen a bunch of times. You get there, and you can take pictures with this sign. You just have to be really careful where you pull off, because
okay.
A mile down the road is the actual Welcome to the Dalton Highway sign and everything. But if you want your incredibly Alaska photos, you're going to do stop at all these signs.
Okay. And when you start, when you say there's nothing to see, when you start the Dalton Highway in the south, you're still in forest?
You're still in forest, yeah.
Okay.
It's still the forest. And the forest runs out north of Coldfoot.
Okay.
So that's why when I said, I talked about Sherry going just to Coldfoot, once you get north of where the forest ends, it's something you've never seen before. But we will get there eventually.
Okay.
The turnout in the first mile is great because it has a couple postings that let you know about the road itself and also who James Dalton himself was. And just it goes through all the warnings again and says, don't take this lightly. And I just have trouble believing that there are tourists out there who would take something like this lightly. But again, not everybody is me. And we heard a lot of funny stories about people who didn't know what they were getting into and the kind of trouble they got into. So
such as
most of the stories revolved around people who did not rent cars, who took cars that were their own. And you would want, we were in a Ford Escape, which is a, okay. I don't even want to call it a mini SUV, but it has a little bit of elevated, it's a little bit higher up than, way higher up than a normal car.
In terms of clearance below the car, yeah.
Yes. And luckily for me, that's the car my wife drives. So I had already had experience. Now it is modified in some ways. It has gigantic mud flaps. And okay. obviously I said the CB radio and everything, and the tires are not your normal tires for that model. The rental car companies put it in place to be able to drive that on the Dalton Highway. But the stories of people driving cars, like one story was of a guy who drove, tried to drive a sports car all the way up. Ooh. Oh my goodness. And they, yeah, he made it, I think 25 miles before he basically ripped out the bottom of his car. So you can do it. You could do it in a low clearance vehicle. I can't imagine it, but I guess you could try it if you really want to. People take RVs up. People bike it. Motorcycles are popular on it. I'm not going to do any of that. I was glad I had the vehicle I did. So, huh. But there are funny stories, and you can find them online. And yeah, there's certainly some amusing people who have tried things. So before we go any further, I want to just read to you some of the rules of the road. Truck traffic has the right of way. So if you got a truck coming at you, you do not want to pull off the road, because a lot of times the road, since it's built on permafrost, it's built up 5, 6, 8 feet high. And if you get off the side of the road in the wrong place, you're going to be down in the ditch, and that is not going to be somewhere you want to be. But you do want to slow down and let the trucks pass. The trucks will kick up, especially in the unpaved section. I think the most common thing other than flat tires on this stretch is cracked windshields.
Sure.
So I would expect that you're going to get covered in rocks when they go by. And every single time, clench your teeth. Bring a mouthpiece if you want, because you're going to be clenching your teeth a lot on this road. Check your rearview mirror constantly. Slower traffic should slow down and move over to allow the trucks to pass. The trucks do drive insanely fast. I was impressed every time I watched these guys flying through. Always drive with your lights on day and night, headlights and taillights. It says to clear them of mud every time you stop, and you'll have to. Huh. Trust me, you'll have to do it. They also put this calcium chloride stuff down on the road, which turns the mud from being regularly like mud into this paste, this hard, almost like rock-like paste. And we took a squeeze bottle of Windex with us so we could be spraying off our lights all the time so that the truckers could see us. Do not stop on bridges, hills, or curves. That's great advice. Almost impossible to follow, because you're going to turn a corner and you're going to be like, oh my goodness, I got to get a picture of this. But don't do it. You're not supposed to do it. Stay on the right side of the road. In the muddiest stretches of the road, there will be like ruts down the middle of the road, and you will, we did it. Everybody does it. But you definitely don't want to be doing that coming up a turn, a blind turn, or it's advice is to stay to the side of the road and do that whenever possible. And then slow down when passing other vehicles to minimize throwing up rocks, which again, I just mentioned it's quite a problem. So
I'm just aware of, at this point in the podcast, about half the audience has stopped listening, which is okay.
Yeah.
Not everything we talk about is going to be for everybody.
Well, you've done so many now that I think we're starting to run around out of the common destination. We thought it was easier than all we'd heard. And I hesitate to say that because I don't want to convince people aren't ready for this to do it. But the fact of the matter is, if you're prepared for the worst, and we were, trust me, we were, but it wasn't as bad as we had thought. And I'm sure if you were completely unprepared, you'd be looking at getting yourself in trouble, where if you're well prepared, this isn't something people can't do. So we should have said that before everybody turned it off. But the first 56 miles or so is mostly dirt. And mile 56, you cross over the bridge over the Yukon River. So the Yukon River and the Yukon River watershed itself, I don't think people understand how enormous this is, because the Mississippi and the Missouri and the Columbia get all the publicity because you've seen them. If you've traveled around the U.S., you've probably crossed over one of these. But the Yukon River itself has an enormous watershed, and it's where you pass over it on the Dalton. It's wide, but it doesn't look anything like the miles you go over when you're passing over the Mississippi. But it's an important ecological river, very important. Back in olden times, it was one of the only ways of transportation for sure. A couple months a year. It's not frozen solid. Just past the Yukon River Bridge is Yukon River Crossing. It's got a cafe there. Part of the year, they do these wonderful noodle dishes. It's a noodle cafe, and that ended on Labor Day, so it was just more common American fare. But we had a good meal there, and it's a place you can get gas. We didn't need it. We had enough gas to get to Colquitt, but they advise people to fill up every place you can.
Sure.
A little tourist shop and everything. And then across the other side of the Dalton is one of the BLM offices and a nice walk, a plate walkway to go out and look, overlook the Yukon River and the thing. So the story of the BLM office there at Yukon River Crossing, when we had picked up the rental car, the people at the rental car agency had said, we don't really know what you're going to see north of Coldfoot. We've heard stories that the road is collapsing, that it's washed out in a number of places. You go, you may have to prepare yourself that you may only get about halfway to Dead Horse and you may not be able to get any further. And so we were obviously unhappy with that with that diagnosis. So when we got to the BLM crossing, we'd done the first 56 miles and the initial rush of being on this road that I've wanted to drive for 25 years had settled, and I'd gotten into it and I kept thinking to myself, this isn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. So we asked the really nice lady who was there, we said, we're really worried about once we leave Coldfoot tomorrow, how hard it's going to be to get all the way to Dead Horse. And she said, we just had a tour group come through here yesterday, and the Alaska Department of Transportation had gotten up there, and not only is the road not bad anymore, they had whole stretches of it they had just redone, which again is another one of those times when I have gotten so lucky travel-wise, because it really wasn't bad. We had heard about 10 to 12 hours from Coldfoot to Dead Horse, and we were like, oh, goodness. My friend Pat said, if it's 10 to 15 hours and we get all the way to Dead Horse, I'm hopping on a plane in Dead Horse and flying back to Fairbanks, and you can drive the stupid car back. So when we heard from the lady at the Yukon River BLM office, we were so relieved that the road was better than we thought. And better or not, I think you'll get a good picture from those people there about what to expect further up the road. They will tell you. In fact, they had a clipboard or something where they wrote down stretches of road to watch out for, and we wrote those down and we took it into account. We were glad we had it. An invaluable source of information.
Now, before you get to the sort of the Yukon River Bridge, that first section of highway, are you pulling off and taking pictures of anything? What are we seeing on this?
So they have a lot of turnouts.
Yep.
And some of these are marked and some aren't. At like mile marker 21, which is perfect. You've got your first 20 miles in. It's mostly dirt. You're breathing easier. Oh, this isn't as bad as I thought. I can handle this. And then you pull over and you see Hess Creek Overlook. And there's a board there on how the forest has returned from some of the bad fires they had in the mid-2000s.
Okay.
So you can actually see from the board. And there are a lot of places to stop. Some are marked, some aren't. But the milepost does a great job of telling you where these places are. They always mention when a place has an outhouse for you to stop at, where's a good picnic spot or whatever. So there are a lot of places to pull over. I'll be honest, I have so many pictures taken out just the windshield, like just looking at the road.
Yeah.
The road itself is just mesmerizing. It's this ribbon running through this massive amount because there are no roads east or west of it of any real substance for the whole of Alaska. There's just nothing up there.
Right.
So the road itself is absolutely mesmerizing. So there's a lot of places to stop. But yeah, you'll also take a lot of pictures out your windshield as well. And we had a GoPro. So we put the GoPro on top of the car in large stretches of it. We just would use the remote from one of our phones and turn the GoPro on. And we've got lots of footage of just driving the road and the forests and the pipeline, which keeps sneaking into view. And you'll stop and take a lot of pictures. So once you leave Yukon River, there's a couple stretches of road that have some funny names. And one of them is called the roller coaster. And we didn't think that stretch was too bad. We'd read about it, but it was kind of up and down, but nothing I thought was crazy insane. And then there are a couple of waysides to stop at, three in particular that are really good. Figure Mountain Wayside is these tufts of rock that have popped up that were left by the glaciers, and it's a good place. They've got a outhouse to go to the bathroom in, and it's got a bunch of signboards and kind of an overlook that you can climb up and look out. The more famous one comes along at mile marker 115, which is the Arctic Circle.
Sure.
So that's the one where everybody wants to get out and take pictures. It was the only place along the road we experienced any like real mosquitoes. So it's kind of in a low-lying area, but they've got a big sign there, and everybody who drives the road stops there and gets their picture at the Arctic Circle. And then Gobbler's Knob is about 20 miles beyond that, and it's an overlook where you finally start getting a view of the Brooks Range, which is the highest mountain range north of the Arctic Circle in the world, and the major dominant feature of the middle part of the Dalton Highway is the Brooks Range. So you finally start to see peaks of that in the distance at this Gobbler's Knob overlook. At mile marker 150 is Grayling Lake, and Grayling Lake is significant because there is archaeological evidence of people there, people settling in the area, or using it as sort of a stopping point travel-wise as much as 3,000 years ago.
Hmm.
Some interesting history on Grayling Lake. And then finally at mile marker 175, you pull into the bustling metropolis of Coldfoot, Alaska, which is really just a hotel, gas station with a restaurant. They have an airport there. They also have a very nice interagency visitor center, one of the best museums I was at in Alaska, which it's BLM, it's state parks, it's also the national, serves as the National Park Visitor Center for Gates of the Arctic National Park up there. And there's lots of fascinating information in this interagency visitor center. They can also advise you on the road to the north. We use them to sort of help us decide when we were going to try to catch the northern lights.
Okay.
They had a good display on that. This is the best chance you're going to have. It's the best night in the next three. You'll have a chance to do that. So as with most national park style visitor centers, it was excellent. Well done. And the people there were passionate and very informative when we did stop in. So also at Coldfoot is there's a campground at Marion Creek, which is just a little bit north of Coldfoot itself. And just beyond Coldfoot is, like I mentioned, Wiseman.
Uh-huh.
Coldfoot has services. Wiseman has just a couple B&Bs. There's no gas station in Wiseman. There's not even a payphone anymore. There's really nothing there. It's a cute little place and historic place. There's an old post office. We were told there was an old mining type museum there, but we never saw it or found it. But it is a nice place to stay overnight. And the nice thing about Coldfoot/Wiseman is it's about halfway.
Right.
So it makes a good place. You drive halfway up, you stop. I've heard of people doing this drive in one day. I know the truckers do. First of all, I don't think you'd see anything. And I just wouldn't want to rush the experience like that. And believe me, after driving 7-8 hours of the Dalton, it's good to stop and relax for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
We were really happy to have gotten something halfway. And the two B&Bs, we really enjoyed both of them. One was called Arctic Getaway, and they had more of cabin-style lodging. And then the other place was called the Boreal Lodge, and that was more – they have some cabins, but they also had, like, motel rooms. They both had internet. Actually, the one place – she said she only did internet between 8 and 10 in the morning, which is fine. We didn't need that either. But the other place, we got just enough to be able to send – emails out to the family letting them know that we hadn't crashed horribly and we're still making our way towards the Arctic Ocean. So that's okay. So the second day drive, a lot of people make the trip to Coldfoot. Mm-hmm. In fact, when we were talking to the people at the BLM office, they said about half the people who drive it only go to Coldfoot and then decide that that's good enough and they go back around. And a lot of the tours only go to Coldfoot. For me, looking at the rest of that road, there was no way I was going to stop at Coldfoot and not at least try to drive the rest of it. As soon as you get out of Coldfoot, there's a really nice stretch of paved road. And at mile marker 204, you come along to Sukakpak Mountain, which is like a razor tip mountaintop and very, it's one of the iconic images of the Dalton. So as soon as you start researching your Dalton Highway stuff, you're going to see images of this mountain everywhere. The morning we left, it was a pretty morning. It rained and even snowed a little overnight. It was a nice foggy morning, and it just had such an incredibly moody feel to it. And we took pictures of the mountain, and we were anxious to get to Adigan Pass, which is where you cross the Brooks Range. And if you read about the Dalton, the thing you're going to read most about, other than just the instructions on how to drive it, are you're going to hear about Adigan Pass, which at 4,700 plus feet is the only place you cross the Brooks Range on a road.
Okay.
And it is gravel. And as you pull up to it, it says avalanche area, please proceed with caution. It has a warning sign to tell you to use your CB before crossing it. So I was breathing pretty heavy when we entered Adigan Pass. And to be honest, it was not terrible. You get to the top. The views on both sides are outstanding. So there's a couple places to pull off.
Well, you talk about the views. You've already passed the last tree at this point.
Yes. Well, and the reason I didn't bring up the last tree is because, honestly, we couldn't find it.
Okay, maybe it's no longer the last tree. Maybe the last tree is the one before that. But you're now in tundra.
Well, you're in mountains.
Mountains, okay.
Tundra comes next.
Okay.
So Adigan Pass, you get to the top, and there's one of these classic snow bowls at the top where the wind over the course of the years has hollowed out one of these roundish caverns there, and there's a place to pull off and sort of catch your breath. We got lucky going up and down the Adigan Pass in that we did not pass any trucks going on up and down the one way and going up and down when we came back down the other way. It probably would be a little more harrowing if you had a truck coming at you, but I didn't think it was bad. There were a lot of potholes. This is one of those stretches where I think doing maintenance on it would be tough because you can't close off the whole road. I mean, they said it right. Does get closed occasionally for avalanches in the winter. This road stays open year round, hence the ice road trucker thing.
Right.
The rental car agencies won't even rent to you in the winter. So if you're that crazy an adventure person, you're going to have to figure out your own car thing. For me, it was good enough. And it was the day we went up over it on the way north, it snowed. It didn't snow hard, but it snowed and the road was definitely full of potholes and definitely choppy. But as far as getting up and over, it wasn't a big deal. And then on the way back, it snowed even harder when we went through, and there was a little visibility issue. And we didn't even stop at the top on the way back. We just wanted to get through it. And it's 20 minutes of tough driving, but nothing most people can't handle. I will say this, when you get over the top of Adigan Pass, like I said, it had snowed at the top. And as we came down heading north on the highway, is my favorite view on the whole highway. Just the road spreads out into the distance, and you can see the mountains as they trail off. And as they trail off, you look beyond there, and it's just a flat line. So you know you've hit the Arctic Coastal Plain, which I've done a lot of traveling, and I had never seen anything like the Arctic Coastal Plain. It is flat. I guess I'd maybe seen some stuff that looked like it in Iceland, but this was just massive as far as the eye could see. There were some small little rolling hills, and these ice heaves they call Pingos. P-I-N-G-O. Yep. Mm-hmm. Those were to the side of the road in a lot of places. But generally, everywhere you looked, it was just flat and tundra. And you really want to know what permafrost is like. The first place you're able to stop after you get out of sort of the Brooks Range is you stop by the side of the road. You walk anywhere off the side of the road, and you feel the sponginess of the tundra, which is just basically the mosses and lichens growing on top of this completely frozen solid layer below it. This is something you've never done. That's the point at which I think you think to yourself, this is about as far north as I'm ever going to get.
Well, and I remember thinking when I was in Iceland and you're walking on that sort of thing that it felt almost Dr. Seussian. I mean, it didn't feel like real land to me.
Yeah.
As somebody who grew up a lot further south. It's beautiful, too.
It is.
A very rugged, stark beauty.
Stark. That is what I was. And I've always said that about I kind of feel that way about the Great Plains in America.
I do as well.
Yep. And as far as like eastern Montana, same thing. There's a stark beauty in this nothingness, but
eastern Montana, you're stretching it now for me, but okay.
Even the Arctic Coastal, it's just you look around and there's these lakes, these small lakes that have formed. And I don't even want to call them lakes because they're, 7 inches to 2 feet deep because they're sitting on top of this basically ice below it. But they're gorgeous and fetching, and they're home to all kinds of migratory birds and their reflections with the sky and the clouds. And Pat and I kept mentioning the quality of light is just different that far north. I can't describe it. I've tried, I've looked for 2 years since I was there trying to describe how the light is different in Alaska, and it just is. It's softer. The sun seems higher in the sky at times, and it's just very strange. And it does give that area real beauty. As far as the Arctic Coastal Plain, though, the drive into Dead Horse, there isn't a lot to stop at. There's the remnants of an old glacial lake there called Galbraith Lake, which has a lot of birds and wildlife. There's a campsite around Galbraith Lake. There's a research station for the University of Alaska at Anchorage and at Fairbanks called Tulik Station, but they have no public facilities. They have a very interesting website where the students that are there document a lot of stuff, including wildlife they've seen and weather they've seen and stuff, but you can't actually visit the station. So when you leave Coldfoot, you're not going in any buildings anywhere until you get to Dead Horse. You're going to have outhouses and stuff that you can stop at, but you're definitely not going in any buildings. So once you're on the Arctic Coastal Plain, it's pretty much straight to Dead Horse. This was the stretch of road that we had been most warned about. And for us, it had just been rebuilt by the Department of Transportation. And the only stretches we didn't like of that road, it was almost all gravel all the way into Dead Horse, especially after the Brooks Range. But the parts we didn't like is when it had been freshly graded and they put fresh stones down. That's the only time I'd wished I'd had a car with bigger tires. It was just a little sloggy, but if you've driven on dirt roads, it's nothing you can't handle. It just was a little bit sloggy. And we took pictures of the car the whole way up just to see where the muddiness came from. And the muddiness in that stretch just tripled. It was absolutely incredible to see how thick the mud was on the car when we got done through this stretch. There's some places to see along the way. The Sag River, which is a much longer native word, which I'm not going to butcher by trying to pronounce the full name of the river. They just call it the Sag River. That joins you about halfway between, and you sort of follow that along the whole way. And there's a couple places where you can drive up on these hills and look out over the plain. And then there's a stretch called the Franklin Bluffs, which appear about 30 miles before you get to Dead Horse, but you don't drive up to the bluffs. You just see them along the way. We were told we'd see a lot of wildlife, and we did see some. The thing we did not see, we didn't see a grizzly bear, so we were a little disappointed. I saw them at other points in time in Alaska, but we did not see any on the trip. You will not see polar bears. So let's get this straight right away. If polar bears are out, they will close that stretch of the road. They don't usually come that close to the Dalton. If the polar bears are out, they won't take you on the tour up to the Arctic Ocean either. Polar bears have a notoriously bad temperament. So they will not have people around polar bears at all. So you won't see them. But we did see caribou and we saw elk. The biggest thing we saw, which was fascinating, was muskox.
Oh,
are you familiar with muskox?
I have seen them in Yukon.
Yeah. And they look like the Banthas out of the old Star Wars movies.
They don't look, they look like, something Hollywood would have thought up. Yeah.
Yeah. They're such an ancient creature and such a history, and they're protected. So only some of the native tribes up there are allowed to hunt them. Mm-hmm. We got lucky because sometimes you see them and sometimes you don't. We saw two different herds, and the herds were in the same places when we went up and down. So we did that stretch on back-to-back days. So but each time we got out, we're fascinated by seeing these creatures that only live in this part of the world on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. That was by far the coolest wildlife experience. We saw on our tour of Prudhoe Bay, we saw Arctic fox, which looks strikingly like a dog. They're very white. And the one we saw on our Arctic Ocean tour was not afraid of humans because he pretty much walked almost right up to us. But we did see a lot of birds as well. But nowhere near the abundance of wildlife I think people had said we were going to, because part of this road also borders the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. So right. You hear that and you're thinking there'll be an abundance of wildlife, but there wasn't a ton. And again, we didn't see any bears, and we did see a moose. Now, we saw a moose crossing the road. By the time we were able to speed up and get up to where we'd watched the moose cross the road, we couldn't see the thing in the brush anywhere. So that was a little disappointing too. But other than that, some people say they have a lot of wildlife experiences. We didn't so much.
I did want to say, you mentioned muskox, little known fact here. In one of the Inuit languages, the name for them means the bearded one, which makes sense because they're just very, very shaggy. But I did like that one of the, I think it's Woods Creek Indian name for them translates to ugly moose or ugly bison, which is just kind of mean.
It's mean and sadly very accurate. I saw them in a wildlife rehab center down outside of Anchorage, a fascinating place you saw from Anchorage. And they are shaggy.
Yep.
But I mean, if considering you have to survive those winters outside, it seems like the perfect evolution to have that much shaggy hair.
Yeah, they're so shaggy. They remind me of some of my friends now in 1 year of COVID lockdown. So
yeah, reminds me of myself after that. So finally, you get into Dead Horse. And so let's just talk briefly about Dead Horse. Dead Horse is simply an oil camp for oil workers.
Right.
It is possibly one of the ugliest places I have ever visited. But you are not there for Dead Horse. And the thing about Dead Horse is you go in and there are no bars. There are no restaurants. The hotels have restaurants. But there's no movie theaters. There's no museum. The Dead Horse doesn't even have a museum. It's got the Brooks Range Supply and Prudhoe Bay General Store, which if there's an attraction anywhere in Dead Horse, that's it. You go in there. You get some postcards. They've got some cheap for the area souvenirs. And they have a huge display of Carhartt stuff. So if you were stupid enough not to dress warmly, you can get all your Carhartt stuff up there in the general store. But generally, on the upper level of a building where the first floor is a massive hardware store, which makes more sense for the type area. But the town, and I use town with quotation marks big time, it's not even really a town. It's just a man-made lake with a ring road around it. We drove around there. It was really nothing to see. There were some very pretty marshlands on each side of the road, so we took some pictures with the reflections and whatnot. But generally, we went to our hotel, which we stayed at the place called Dead Horse Camp, which the company we use, Arctic Outfitters, is the sister company of a place called Northern Alaska Tour Company. And the Northern Alaska Tour Company helps you book your hotel up there. It helps you book your Arctic Ocean shuttle. So the hotel is, again, it's on stilts. It's a prefabricated building on stilts. And you go into the bathroom and all the plumbing is like above the ground right below you. The showers are, they tell you to try to limit them because they have to truck all the water in and out. And it's almost like living on the moon. It's very unique. We had a great meal in the cafeteria there. They serve the oil workers first, and then you come in, the tourists come in after and have this buffet. The buffet was made by a certified chef who does 6 months up there and makes enough money doing it that he lives the other 6 months of the year in Belize. That would be an interesting place to live for 6 months, but they don't really have any permanent population up there. Most of the people do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, which we found out when we did our Arctic Ocean tour. Now, what we had to do to that is book this tour in advance, and the tour bus comes to the hotel, picks you up in the morning, and it drives you through the massive BP. I don't even think it's owned by BP anymore, but it's the massive oil field. And you learn a lot about the oil field operations and whatnot, but they drive you out to this little peninsula, and there's the Arctic Ocean. The ocean was 36 degrees the day I was up there in September. I had planned the whole time. I'd brought my swimsuit with me. I'd planned to dive in. And when it came down to it, I got about knee deep, and I satisfied my need to put my feet in every major ocean. And we did have one person on our tour group who did do the dive. The fact is, it's a pebbly beach. It's not a sand beach. Once you get 2 feet into the ocean itself, it's very mucky, and the bottom starts to give out very quickly. And I just, it was not what I had anticipated. So I was glad enough to get my feet in. You get your picture, you're there for 15 minutes. It's not an attractive beach. There's leftover oil equipment, like there's leftover oil barrels and stuff out there. The tour is not cheap. It's 2 hours and I think it was $70.19 when I went, but it's the only way you're going to get to the Arctic Ocean itself. Now, the Dempster Highway episode you and I talked about before we got on, episode number 679, that highway is in Canada, and you can actually drive straight out to the Arctic Ocean and walking yourself. This is not that. So that's the one bummer of it, is that you have to pay to get on the shuttle, and you want to make your shuttle reservations in advance because those could fill up as well.
Okay.
So when you're done, for us, we did the Arctic Ocean shuttle in the morning, and then we turned and got back on the Dalton, and we had 500 more miles to go back to Fairbanks. That's the thing about the Dalton. It's one way up and one way back. And the road looks different as you drive south. It's Alaska, so you're going to get different weather on the way back south. We finally got the Northern Lights on our last day when we got back to Wiseman halfway through. They had given it about a 20% chance that we would see any of the famous Aurora Borealis. And we got very lucky in that they said, well, you got, somebody's got to stay up between 9 p.m. and 3 a.m. So my friend Pat took the 9 to 12 shift, and I set my alarm for midnight. And I saw a note from him when I got up at 11:30 saying, cloudy, no lights. And he had gone back to bed at 11:30. I went out and froze for about a half an hour, was getting ready to go back to bed. And I noticed there was some, looked like powdered sugar was active in the sky. And I had taken an online photo course before I went on how to photograph the Northern Lights, because I would have no way to know that. So I hooked it up, slowed down my shutter speed, did a couple of things I learned about. And I said, well, I'm going to, whatever this powdered sugar in the sky stuff is, I'm just going to shoot that. And then I'm going to go back to bed. I shot it, waited for the shutter speed to go through, and then looked at the viewfinder. And what was white to the eye was green to the camera. Hmm. And I said, oh my goodness, those are the Northern Lights. So I went in and woke my friend up. And by the time he stumbled out of bed and got outside, the sky had just blown up. And it was greens, and the outsides are purple. And the Northern Lights are an experience I just cannot explain. Now, the thing about seeing them in Alaska, especially in Wiseman, is most people who see them in the U.S. see them as just green on the horizon.
Right.
We were right under the aurora itself. So they were literally right above us. Like, you had to tilt your head up to see them. It was remarkable. They hung out for about 45 minutes. They started to fade. And by 1:30 in the morning, they were gone. It was remarkable. It's one of those things I'll never forget. We just goosebumps the whole time. Just absolute goosebumps the whole time.
Excellent.
So it was an amazing thing to do. And we were just so fortunate to have gotten lucky to see them.
Well, and we won't do all the mile markers in reverse. It was the
same as
you went on the way up. So we'll get to some of our wrap up questions. Prettiest spot. You're standing at the prettiest spot on the Dalton Highway. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
Well, for me, heading northbound out of Adigan Pass, you see the Brooks Range stretch off into the distance and the road. And I have it as my screensaver on my computer, and I just adore the spot. Coming back the other way, though, when you have one of the overlooks looking southbound from Adigan Pass, it's just as pretty a viewpoint.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say, only on the Dalton Highway.
I would think getting overconfident and saying, oh, yeah, this is a good stretch of road, and creeping your speed into the upper 40s, and then bam, one of those just killer potholes. And yep, that's the other thing. Truly Dalton is, my friend Pat called it the cone of awareness. They would have these road cones, and they would just put them in the every once in a while you would see one just in the middle of one of these massive potholes. Not that that's going to, in the city they'd have it all the way around it, but in the Dalton they just pop it in the middle, and it's just, we're just letting you know this is here. If you choose to hit the outside of it, it's all on you. But the cones of awareness, wonderful.
And if you had to summarize the Dalton Highway in just three words, what three words are you going to use?
Singular, remote, and gorgeous.
Excellent. Now, I've always had the issue with returning rental cars that they say if you return it dirty, you have to pay more. What do you do when you take a car off the Dalton Highway and return it to the rental car?
To be honest, they tell you to not wash it because they have to use a special type of washing. They told us a story that they had a guy, a tourist, who had brought the rental car back, and it was an artist, and he had done this elaborate art in the stuff that was caked into the side. The problem is if you write on it, it scratches the paint. So he ended up paying thousands of dollars in damage fees. So they said, do not wash it yourself. They said, bring it back. That will be covered in. And the car rentals are pricey.
Yeah,
I think we paid almost $250 a day for ours, and you're getting what you're paid for. So that's the only way to do it.
Excellent. Well, our guest again has been Eric Smith. The pictures in this episode are probably going to be mostly Eric's pictures. And Eric, thanks so much for coming back on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for the Dalton Highway.
Thanks for having me back, Chris.
In news of the community, thanks again go out to the patrons of the show who help support the show with their donations. And if you want to be a patron, you can get the show early, get to be part of a monthly Zoom call, and also, depending on what level you pledge, get some tchotchkes like stickers and mugs. If you're interested, go to patreon.com/amateurtraveler. I heard from Wes on the show that we did recently on Central Oregon, and Wes said, a couple of suggestions from my 3 weeks in Oregon in 2019. The Kam Wah Chung Chinese Heritage Site in John Day, Oregon, is a perfectly preserved Chinese general store discovered undisturbed since its last use in 1948. Talk about a throwback to the 40s and Chinese American culture from that era. It's a fantastic use of 1 hour of your time. Also headed toward the John Day region, and for the intrepid traveler, the Spoke and Hostel converted hostel / Sunday church is a great layover for bike travelers and those headed into accommodation sparse John Day region. The pastor couple running the hostel are exceptionally friendly. It's in the little town of Mitchell, a stagecoach stop that's probably hasn't changed since its last stagecoach left. On my two-night stay, I got invited to the town's lively hoedown, featuring the local talent, and enjoyed some local town fare. Thanks so much, Wes. Kim commented on the same episode and caught me on Twitter, where I am Chris2X, C-H-R-I-S, the number 2 followed by an X, and said, I highly recommend the High Desert Museum for a day, and the High Desert Museum is in Bend, Oregon. And with that, I think we'll wrap up this episode of the Amateur Traveler Podcast. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com, and thanks so much for listening.